said talk to me, damn it, or else I'm gonna throw you in the fire!
You stupid bitch, you filthy!
Welcome back to Flyover State of Fear. We got a great guest for you this week in Lon Harris, and of course my co-host Brian. How you doing, Lon? How you doing, Brian?
Pretty good.
Yeah. Well, doing well.
Doing well.
He got it grammatically correct. I did not.
Yeah.
That's probably the first time in my life I've ever done that, and only because I think about it every time I say good. And then I was like, since you said good first, I had the opportunity to do that thought when you said it.
Yes, yeah.
And I was like, I'm going to say well this time.
You know what?
And look, enough, it really backfired, kind of.
Send enough work emails all day.
Because I called you out on it,
yeah. Send enough work emails all day and that hope you're well. Nope, I am doing well. That is consistent from 11 to noon, or from 9 to noon.
11 to noon? What a work day.
No, that's, I meant to say really 9 suffering. To noon. In the morning,
suffering under the yoke of the man with that.
Nine all day
from the early hours of 11 a.m. till the late till the crack of noon.
Now 9 to 5.
The guy, that and podcaster hours, huh?
That 1 hour work podcast. Oof.
My goodness,
Lon, you are
a freelance writer.
Lon, from 11 to noon, you are our most returning guest at the moment, so thanks for being here there. We talked to Invasion of the Body Snatchers, and I remember you introduced that to me, and I was thinking about us talking about the episode recently, because I was just like, I'm pretty sure I spent the whole time being like, I can't believe Donald Sutherland was a lead in the 70s. They're all so unique looking, and that was like most of my commentary. So
it's true. I was
mesmerized by the ugliness of actors in the 70s.
All 70s movies, when you go back now, you're like, they were allowed to look like that? Say you didn't have to be on human growth hormone for 4 months before appearing in a movie? That was not a rule?
That's crazy. True. Like before the early 2000s, when a man takes his shirt off on film, you're like, that's a regular normal human.
Yes. Looks like a guy. Even like a celebrity. Like sometimes you'll be watching a movie and it'll be like Jimmy Kahn is the romantic lead, and then he'll take off his shirt and he just looks like Jimmy Kahn. He's not, yoked.
He doesn't do a groundskeeper Willie and rip his shirt off.
But everything from everything. Even we were just watching, I mean, it was like the 80s, but we were watching Monkey Shines and a young Stanley Tucci pops up. And I mean, he's a handsome man, but he's, he's receding like the rest of us.
You would call him hairy. You would call him wiry,
But it's crazy because like the hottest dudes from 70s movies compared to guys today, like Robert Redford, a very handsome man, don't get me wrong, but like in 70s movies, he still kind of looks like a regular guy too.
Yeah.
Like just a very attractive regular guy.
It's such the truth, but I was thinking about that the other day.
No one was an expendable in 1977. Just like one person.
Like
it's
arguably,
to talk about that during before this movie too, because like the lead that you're kind of, I mean, at least supposed to, he's the closest thing to a character you're supposed to connect with, is also the Northman. So
right, that's what I mean. Like Alexander Skarsgård is like baseline for starring in a 2023 movie,
and he's like huge.
He's believable as a Viking. Like he didn't have to do anything extra. They were just put this braid in your hair, and here's the sword. Now you're a Viking.
Yeah. And then in this movie, he's supposed to be like the most pathetic man you've ever seen.
Right.
It's making me chuckle thinking about it the other day. So speaking of that, you guys mentioned the Northman and stuff. Before we get into Infinity Pool, You guys watch anything recently, or like have any current recommendations in the, you know, in the genre?
Did you guys see Cobweb? That one's popping up on streaming now.
I want to watch it. I've not got to see it yet, though.
I enjoyed it. I mean, I don't know if consent, like, when you, if somebody told you, like, here's what happens in Cobweb, I don't think it sounds like that great. Like, it's a little bit thin in terms of the premise, but it, as an excuse for Antony Starr and Lizzie Kaplan to just really play into being creeps. Mm-hmm. It's fantastic.
Like, it's fun.
They're both really great in it and very creepy. And just as a showcase for that, like, we just got these two really good character actors and let them go nuts with it. I think it's a lot of fun.
Lizzie Kaplan in that, you know, yeah. So check out Cobweb. It's also that great combining of a nice haunted house story, or kind of what you think is going to be a haunted house story. Yeah. Like, creepy kid shit. So yeah, Cobb, what was a nice surprise. It's on, I think it's on Hulu right now.
It's on Hulu. It just popped up on Hulu.
Yeah. It's kind of good. I want to see it. Because I just, speaking of Hulu, I just watched The Boogeyman. This year. Very bog standard, kind of by the numbers. It had a bit of a cool monster in it, but everything was pretty, like, I would hope Cobweb was a step above what I thought of Boogeyman.
This is a good double feature here. Kind of what I did, actually, those two movies back to back.
Yeah. I like that Boogeyman movie. Oh, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, Cobweb and Boogeyman have, like, the same DNA, except Cobweb's the fun art kids, the fun indie art kids version of, like, I think kind of what the Boogeyman has in it. But Boogeyman's just your generic studio horror movie, and I enjoyed the fact that it was that. I was like, it's kind of refreshing.
I did. The Stephen King story has this hook that they sort of use, which is the idea that the boogeyman can impersonate other people. Like, that's what's scary.
Mimic part of it, yeah.
Right,
yeah.
Cool. You think it's your dad or your therapist or whatever, but then actually it's the boogeyman. And they don't really use that in the movie hardly at all. It's very much
The thing, like, talking and making noise a lot, but they never really, like, make that a focus of it using that very much.
I feel like a lot of movies were kind of in this neo J horror moment, where a lot of movies are going back to, like, The Ring and The Grudge and, like, that sort of format. Like, Smile was the one I noticed, where, like, oh, this is just a J horror curse movie. Like, that's exactly, like, where
I feel like Talk to Me has some of that.
Talk
too.
To Me was the other one I was just thinking of, where it's like, yeah, you get the curse, and then there's, like, rules, and it's like you've got so many days, and then the hallucinations get more and more intense as the person investigates and gets closer to the answer. And I feel like Boogeyman was doing that too, but it's a weird fit. Like, Boogeyman's not that kind of story. It worked okay. I just thought it was a weird mix.
It's interesting you said that, because I was just talking about, like, you know, how horror definitely has its places and, like, timelines, right? Like, it's the trends happen every couple years and they go away and they come
cycles, a new one. And peaks and valleys,
so, like, the J horror of the early 2000s, and then it went into, like, found footage again, and then, like, and I was just saying, like, the recent trend, but it sounds like now it's a hybrid of it, and is like elevated horror is what I would say, you know, that term would be like, that's the high everyone's chasing. But half of that actually is what you're saying, this, like, curse horror trend.
Well,
is like
a lot
most
of those
elevated
yeah, a lot of those elevated horror movies were just, like, taking the J, like, It Follows is the best example, where it's like, that's another one that's just a J horror curse movie. Yeah. They just tweaked it.
So I love that you brought it up, just because, like, literally was given this rundown of, like, you know, word vomiting for 3 minutes at a coworker of, like, here's the history of horror from the from 70s to 2003. And the J horror was where we got hung up on. I'm like, no, you got to go back and look. And it was like that, and, like, torture porn and bad studio horror. And I was
right.
Like,
right. And there's always, like, different stuff going on at once. Yeah. I feel like that, just like horror movies where people are cursed and there's a bunch of, like, rules that they got to figure out. And it's usually like, it's often a woman and often like a journalist, or she's investigating like the origin, like I gotta find the first person who was cursed and then the reason that they
were
cursed.
Yeah, they always have that element too where they go back and find the person who's also dealing with it.
Right.
And, like, that's in all of them.
Who was the first wet dead girl that gave rise to the phenomenon?
I just watched.
You gotta go find Brian Cox before he just like
turns
himself.
Yeah. Oh yeah, it's always a variation on that.
I just watched the Grudge, the American Grudge the other day, just throw it on. Oh, that movie's so boring and so bad. But I was talking about it and I was like, not even the Grudge. I said, yeah, the Ring has creepy moments, but it's basically became an episode of like CSI eventually by plot beats, or like a detective show that you watch just with the haunted girl.
Well, that's like, the thing. Those American J-horror and ripoffs always added a half hour for no reason, so they lost like they don't move the same. They feel a little slow now.
Well, Bill Paxton jumping off a bridge, or Bill Pullman.
There is a challenge of adapting, like sometimes, especially Japanese movies, because the Japanese they don't have the same like. Americans have this like charging, like we want the narrative to be like really fast, and every scene links together. And this leads to that, leads to that, A to B to C to D, and then that's the end of the story. And like the moment you deviate from that, American audiences start to lose patience. Like, well, what's going on? This doesn't. This sex scene is not necessary for the plot. And I feel like Japanese audiences don't have that. You can introduce like four different stories and maybe they'll eventually interconnect, or you can introduce a character and sometimes it's very episodic. They go do this, they go have this adventure, they go have that. Like Branded to Kill, I remember the first time I watched that, it was very frustrating because it's like, well, okay, you meet this character and he's got this overarching need, but then it's all like 20-minute things. He has to go deal with this, and then he has to go deal with this, and this might not have anything to do with what he was already doing. And I think that makes it harder to adapt these stories.
I think the
Japanese are more patient about like, okay, this will all link together. It's about a mood. It's about establishing tone. And Americans like, we don't give a shit about that. We just want to know what happens.
Give me the payoff.
Tell me what's going to happen next.
Your point is, that is why I'm so glad to this day we never got a remake of Audition, which I think, you know, that's a top, I mean, it's pretty beat to death now, but that's like a top three J-horror, like legendary movie. Does that, though. It's just, you know, the first hour is a rom-com of that movie, and then you're just like, wait a minute. So
yeah, a lot of Takashi Miike, where it's just like because they keep talking about Ichi the Killer too, and they want to do a U.S. version of that, but it's kind of the same. It's like, well, this part is about this, and this, but it's from different characters' perspectives, even, and like, I don't know.
Let's just have Americans Spike Lee just won't make Coldboy again, you know?
Right, Americans just won't tolerate that.
No,
Koreans are more like us. I feel like Korean movies are
film. Yeah.
He's got to get there, you know? He's going to go there, then he's going to punch that guy really hard.
A lot more Western influence, and, like, I mean, you could even see that in, like, the, you know, the common one of the mainstream one of, like, Bong Joon-ho stuff, right? Like, it's pretty, like, palpable, and, but yeah, no, they're super great. We got to cover some J-horror more on this show, Brian. So we picked Infinity Pool, and I think this stemmed from, like, a conversation we, the three of us, were kind of having on Twitter, and then, like, months later, we were like, Lon, you want to talk about Infinity Pool?
Probably. That sounds right.
Or anything to add? Apologies. Anything to add, guys, that you wanted to recommend? Or, yeah, I think we're in a good spot.
No, we're good. We can start the movie now.
Yeah, so I'll read the synopsis just to see if it's accurate to what we watch. And as you guys know, I have not read it yet. Guided by a seductive and mysterious woman, a couple on vacation venture outside the resort grounds and find themselves in a culture filled with violence, hedonism, and untold horror. A tragic accident soon leaves them facing a zero-tolerance policy for crime. Either you'll be executed, or if you're rich enough to afford it, you can watch yourself die instead. That's pretty weak synopsis. I feel like kind of all over the place with that one.
Well, it's just like the very base level, you know what I mean? And that's in a it's hard for Google to give a synopsis of what this movie's really about. You know what I mean?
It's like, a hard one to explain. It's a hard one to explain. So I know just from our conversations too, like Lon and myself watched the one, the Theatrical Cut, which on Hulu. Brian, you said you went ahead.
I watched the Theatrical Cut, and then I noticed that the uncut version was on Canopy. And if I'm being completely honest, I think it was mostly just like
sex stuff, like, right?
Well, slightly more graphic sexual elements to some of the, especially during like the orgy scenes, and not even like showing a lot, but like what was like involved in some of the like kind of flashing images, mm-hmm. and things that were like morphing into each other.
Yeah.
And you know, I think also the surprise hand job is a little bit more graphic in that.
You know
this
what?
One,
I think
so.
I.
You know, but if you've been on Pornhub, you've seen everything that Infinity Pool is going to show you.
Gotcha. I think I did watch the director's cut the first time, because I watched it online, you know, from
Spot,
and I was like, I couldn't tell, but yeah, that hand, I remember that hand job being a little longer.
This is a Brandon Cronenberg thing, because Possessor also has an uncut version that's not really very different, and it's mostly, again, during the, like, freak out, psychedelic montage sequences. Anyway, there's like he puts slightly more graphic imagery in there, but it goes by so quickly it's almost like you don't fully register what you're seeing even.
Gotcha. So Lon, you were just saying earlier we're talking about Brandon Cronenberg. So this is David Cronenberg's son, Brandon Cronenberg, who's you said made Possessor. I've only seen Possessor, but he's kind of following his father's footsteps a bit with the
interesting ways.
I was actually interested to see what
everybody thought comparatively. I mean, obviously, you know, there's a huge body of work from David Cronenberg, but like I've recently watched Dead Ringers and Videodrome for the first time, both.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And while I enjoyed them and stuff, I find
we froze.
Well, I enjoy Brandon Cronenberg's movies, and it feels like he's kind of starting out from, you know, his father has become this sort of respected, world-renowned art film festival kind of filmmaker, and he's following in those footsteps.
Yeah.
And that's a very different way to start your career.
Yeah.
And David Cronenberg, who was making grade Z freak out,
splatter,
low budget splatterhouse horror movies. And I think what makes David Cronenberg's, especially that transitional, like the Fly, Dead Zone, Videodrome era, The Brood, The Furious Bride of Palma. What makes that era so interesting is that transition. That, like, it's this guy who's got this command of low budget filmmaking, of gross out filmmaking, of gore hound sort of filmmaking, but he's a thoughtful, smart guy.
He's using that, but he's making real art with it. Like, he's not just
like,
doing splatter movies. I agree.
I don't think anything in Brandon's oeuvre yet matches, like, the climactic stuff from The Fly or Videodrome, or where he really marries those two worlds in ways that are very weird and very effective and singular. Like, there's no other horror filmmaker whose movies feel like that era of Cronenberg.
This is the closest thing I'd say to like a Videodrome, just from like thematics of like sexuality and imagery.
I mean,
and stuff.
It's interesting. I mean, they both obviously have in some ways there's body horror elements to what both of them are doing, but I do feel like that's way more like I don't know. I think Brandon's more of a like social commentary, satirical kind of guy. And I feel like that's David Moore is really hung up on like the existential terror of having a body.
And I think that's more what I meant when I was talking about like focus is like Brandon Cronenberg's clearly like got something he's trying to say and he's like pointing in a specific direction. Where like I feel like David Cronenberg's just like, here's some ideas. Look at some crazy. This is like, think about some crazy shit. And think about what it means to, like, be a human being in a body and whatever, like, yeah, you know.
Bodies are weird, folks.
I do think it's more coherent than bodies are weird, but sure. I mean, it's very different, and I feel like Brandon, like, it's a lot of face stuff. Like, it's even less like body horror. I mean, I guess a little bit, like, Possessor definitely has that, like, what does it mean to be like a mind and a body and how those two things are connected. But all Brandon Cronenberg's movies are really, it's about, like, people with messed up, morphed, freakish faces and how, like, even a small tweak to your face makes you look like a monster, and, like, how we're so used to, like, faces can look very different and diverse, mm-hmm. but there are certain things that you can't change or else immediately it's very wrong. And yeah. and I like that element of it, but it does feel very different than what David is getting at.
Yeah.
Yeah. No,
it's funny that he, like you said, he feels like he's making it, like he's building on, like starting from the more art house version of what people see, but also, like, I don't know, doing something different with it too, I guess. You know what I mean? Like, he's starting from a place of a more...
It's cool to see also, like,
good nepotism.
He's becoming a voice for, like, his country of a Canadian filmmaker, too. Like, there's very few of them that are having this impact around and, like, having crossed the board right now and being like, no, I'm going to stay in Canada. Because I heard Matt Johnson from Nirvana, the band, the show, he just made Blackberry.
Oh, yeah.
He mentioned, like, essentially, I guess, their director's class being, like, using Brendan Cronenberg as, like, an example of, like, it's me and him and a few others just trying to do more and stay here and do that. So I thought that was really
the neat. Canadian film
industry.
Well, it is. I mean, there are, like, English speaking countries that are not the US. The moment you have, you know, a little taste of international success, there is a lot of pressure to, like, well, just go to Hollywood now. Mm-hmm. I've heard Australian filmmakers talk about this a lot.
Oh my God.
There's a real lack of mature Australian filmmaking because those guys all pull a Peter Weir the moment they get a little international attention. It's like, well, I'm going to go make Master and Commander, you know, like, why am I going to hang around in Perth and make Perth budgets when I could go to the US and make America budgets?
We can only hope that.
So I think that's probably the same thing in Canada, especially because they're so close. It's like you could drive to.
Yeah, come on over.
You make a couple of, you direct a couple episodes of the X-Files, and then the next thing you know, or whatever, you know, whatever's working up there.
Yeah,
and you
exactly.
do your first feature, and you get your boots under you, and then you go to Hollywood.
A little more. So they did film this one, though, in Croatia. So, but anyway,
I do like that, because it's, I like that he makes it impossible to tell even what part of the world this fictional country is in. At first, you sort of assume it's like South America, Central America.
That was my assumption at first. Then
I was thinking like Greece, maybe, also.
Right, but then they all have kind of Eastern European act. Like, he obviously used a lot of Croatian locals in some of the bit parts and whatever. So, like, the people don't seem South American. But then, like Thomas Kretschmann, who's a German guy, is their you know, government representative. It's, there's just no way to know,
it's,
like, where we are in the world.
Latolka, yeah.
Yeah.
And so we do start off, right, this couple, this clearly, like, yuppie couple in this resort, or, you know, down on vacation.
Coleman also in Cobweb, right?
Yes.
She's
the very bad substitute teacher who
so,
makes all the wrong moves.
Oh, yeah, you gotta watch.
I know her from Last Man on Earth.
That's what I was saying. Which was just so, like, the voice. I was like, how do I, like, I could just hear her voice. I'm like, how do I fucking know? I wonder. I was like, oh yeah, 45 episodes or whatever of Last Man on Earth.
Yeah,
but yeah, she is in Cobweb too. So.
Yeah, she plays a terrible substitute teacher who tries to do the right thing, but makes zero.
But makes every mistake.
Like
a classic horror movie helper.
Two phone calls, and that movie could have
really solved some stuff pretty easily, but just does not do anything right.
But it's her and God, I mess up every
Skarsgård.
Alexander, I was going to say Alexander. I saw myself. It's not even a bit. I generally mess up all the Skarsgårds. So they're on vacation and they meet a different couple, vacation friends, right? This is the, like, opposite side version of that Hulu movie.
Vacation That'd be a great Friends. Crossover. They should just make that. Or the vacation friends go to this resort, and like you get a bunch of John Cena clones running around. And
I feel like Brandon Cronenberg must have gone on some kind of vacation, and this makes a observation that I feel like everybody who's been to this kind of resort has felt this way, where when you go to a place that's like not supposedly safe outside of the boundaries of where you're visiting, and it's this weird feeling as a tourist to be like, I'm here, but I'm not really here. Like, I'm not really experiencing what this place is really about. I'm getting only the filtered, like, tourist version because I'm at the resort. And like, I went on a few years ago. My uncle treated the family to a Caribbean cruise for a week, where you go to like St. Kitts and St. Martin, and then Costa Rica, and then back in like a week. But you know, you don't really go to those places. You go, land, and then you go to a port, and then they take you to a beach, and they sell you some expensive cocktails, and then they take you back to the boat, and you're gone. You don't see, like, the island of St. Kitts and who's really living there and what's really happening there. So I feel like not a lot of movies that I've seen have really tapped into that specific feeling or vibe.
It feels like a lot of people have had it immediately. Like
there's a little moment right. I was on my second watch. There's a great little moment they just loved when that guy on the ATV, you know, drives on the beach. He's like running over. They cut to Alexander Skarsgård and his shocked little face of like, oh, he's like literally clutching his pearls. It's so funny. a little bit of the real world broke in here. Ooh, scary.
And that's his first fucking red flag, though. Where I go. When it's like, oh no, we're gonna take the car out, you know, the catalyst where we get it. I'm just like, these morons. You know, I'm sorry, you go away to those resorts. You know, not to be like, well, we're just gonna do our own thing because it's fine.
Yeah.
Like, but no.
Well, and also, they make it like there's multiple compounds. Like they kind of make mention of.
They kept
like,
mentioning it's all kind of a connected kind of
right. There's another resort, but it really is kind of like
that's
that
like
in
I was in Jamaica a couple years ago for a destination wedding, and it was the same thing. You're in your resort. There's a bunch of different resorts.
Right. And I remember even in Hawaii, which is not like it's safe, you could go anywhere. But even that is like. Well, there's this cluster of resorts, and then you got to drive like 40 minutes around to get to the next cluster of resorts.
We went on an excursion, so you're out of the thing, but you know, because you got to get somewhere for the boat. And I remember being like, well, I'm just going to run across the street to the local shop to buy like a hat or something, right? And immediately being like, having a thought of what am I doing in this as an alone American about to go on the excursion, what am I doing in this shop buying a hat with more money than I'm sure I need on me and getting back over to the resort? But like, all right, cool. Not resort, but like the excursion.
But yeah, so I like that this movie is kind of plays into that feeling and that anxiety and like exploring it, you know, and the ultimate result too being the people he really had to fear were not the Tolkiens, not the people living on this island or in this country, but the people he was with, the people from the resort that were sending out into Latolka.
And
of all the different like I'm rich and now I'm in a crazy situation movies that came out this last year or two, this one is the only one that kind of tapped into that. And there's been a lot of them.
Yeah,
there's a lot of Eat the Rich movies out right now, last few years.
But I feel like this one, too, it understands the allure. And so it's not purely like rich people are horrible. I mean, it is.
Oh, no.
But it's also about how they seduce him and how he finds himself drawn into this world over the course of, you know, an hour or whatever.
Yeah, speaking of that, so they get there, he's an author, he has like one book he's written, he clearly has no more ideas, and we've already set up that he's also married rich. Like, he wasn't a rich author, he's married rich, and, but Mia Goth is basically just like, and they do give off like swinger vibes, her and her husband immediately, like, but they're like, oh my God, you're, I'm not going to remember these people's names. You're so and so author.
Oh, James Foster.
James Foster.
Such a sucky baby.
James!
James! James! you know, I love your book, this and that. So he's gonna be like, yeah, we gotta hang out with these people. And like, I don't know if you guys have been away like that and have had like vacation friends before, but there is that level of like, do we follow them? Not out of the resort, but like, we should try to get together and like follow them around. Like, me and my wife have had that before. We're like,
or you like start bumping into people multiple places, yeah. And you're like, okay, well, we'll just kind of, they seem nice.
We'll hang
and
for
we're
a bit.
Always
we'll
going
have a few
to the
drinks.
Same spots anyway. Like, yeah.
And then
they're also building up like right away. They've established. He does a really good job of establishing a lot of these character dynamics, you know, in a pretty subtle way with shorthand. He's a good writer. Because like you get like there's that initial where they're having breakfast and she wants to go do an activity or go to town and he's like, I don't care. He's very, very out of it. I barely says two words to her the whole beginning mm-hmm. of the movie. And then as soon as these rich people who are impressed by him and he's attracted to the woman,
he kind of like comes to life. Yeah.
We're going to go to this dumb Chinese place. 2 minutes ago, he said he had no way. Like, why would they have a Chinese place in Latolka? Whatever. now he's suddenly engaged and interested. So it's like, we're kind of learning a lot about this relationship that he has with his wife, I guess.
Yes.
Yeah, his partner of 10 years, that they've been together for 10 years, and, you know, he's bored, they're bored of each other, he no longer has to perform for her or make her feel entertained or enraptured, yeah. But this new person and this new opportunity brings him suddenly, you know, to life and gets him engaged, and I think that's a lot of what the movie is about. Like, there are all of these ideas about rich and poor and about power dynamics and whatever, but I do think it's also just about, you know, just about that like when you are not rich but you're in a world surrounded by wealth and privilege, it's very easy to
get allured and wrapped into it,
seduced by it, and just start believing that you belong there, and whatever you'd have to do to stay would be justified. It's got like a talented Mr. Ripley sort of vibe to it almost. That's the same thing he experiences, that like, well, but now I've been here for so long, it would be cruel to expect me to go back to the world of the plebs, you know.
Live like a poor again. Ugh.
Right. Ugh, gross.
I did love the scene where Mia Goth is talking about her job as the commercial actor, and she's basically doing Janine Garofalo from Mr. Show. She's like, Bag Hutch, help me.
There has to be a better way.
I love it.
You're like, oh, wow, what a great actress you are. She's like, yeah, I know, I'm really good. they do that, and then
I love that one with Judy Garofalo where it's like the test to determine if you have a headache. That was an old Saturday Night Live bit she was on. She's like, in only 5 minutes, I'll know if I have a headache. Oh God, I'm in agony.
That's good.
Yeah,
I didn't mean to interrupt. I'm sorry.
No, you're good.
Big Garofalo fan. There should be more Garofalo talk on the pod. Actually,
more Garofalo.
Her
for Wet Hot American Summer.
Yeah. From the Ben Stiller Show to Wet Hot American Summer, I celebrate her whole oeuvre.
To playing herself in The Sopranos.
Yeah.
Was it Outlaw Lesbians?
Oh, yeah, that movie. I just rewatched The Sopranos. Not to get off topic, I've just did a rewatch of The Sopranos, and now I'm listening to Pod Yourself a Gun slowly. I'm not in a big rush or anything. But, oh, man, so that episode, the movie they're making looks just awful. It's so terrible.
Hey, Christopher is enamored by that movie.
Cleaver, on the other hand.
A classic.
Cleaver looks excellent.
Brilliant. Like Saw.
Yeah, absolutely.
But anyway, so we have these scenes, you know, we set up all the characters, and like you said, these little things kind of roll through the dynamics of them, and they go to a beach, and they borrow a car from a local or like a resort.
They leave the compound, which you're not supposed to do. Big no.
And I mean, literally, my first note is they're on the beach, they're eating, and I just write. And the biggest thing is, they could have done the same thing at the resort. Like, they're not doing anything different. They're just sitting on a beach, drinking wine and like eating cheese. Like it's. And anyway, they have that. They get drunk.
Turkish sausage, right?
Yes. Oh, I can't have another one. Like, they have enough there where he has, like, a hot plate and a skillet. Like, they prepared.
Frying up sausages.
But get drunk. Mia Goth Mia Goth jerks them all. Well, his wife goes away. Mia Goth, you know, just
right. Surprise them. Surprise.
Seduces Skarsgård when his wife and her husband assumably go away, and he's just silent and kind of freaked out the whole right away. All drunk, he decides, "I'll drive back. I'm good enough." His lights go out, and they hit a kid, or they hit a worker.
He's like a farmer, right? A
farmer, yeah. And they do a hit and run, basically. They get back to the resort. They're all like, "What the fuck did you do?"
Well, yeah, like Mia Goth and her husband basically are like, "You can't go to the police, you know."
Yeah, or they tell them
you'll get murdered, you know.
You're in a foreign country. I mean,
you have to do a hit. Again, this has to be a hit and run.
And they're playing on this couple's fears about Latolka, about this foreign country, this backwards. Mm-hmm. She's like, "They're going to rape you. The cops are going to rape you, and then they're going to kill you. And you can't, there's no justice in Latolka." So they're really playing on, they're the criminals. They're the ones who
they know what to do. Wrong. I mean, like, the spoiler of this is, right, like, later on, like, Mia Goth's like, "I can't even believe how stupid we didn't have to set you up for a crime." Right. Like, they were planning on.
Later on, the reveal is right that they purposefully picked him to be like a plaything and to manipulate him and to get him in trouble and just to see.
But then he got himself in trouble anyway, and they didn't even have to do it.
Right. But I do think like that there throughout the movie, there's constantly these references to playing on Western and American fears about the other and the dusky, dangerous foreigners who are just waiting around every corner to take advantage and to rob us and to kill us and all of this talk. It reminded me a little bit. I went to Peru years ago and took a trip, and then I saw a thread recently that was like, "No one would ever go to South America as a tourist alone. You'd have to be crazy." And it's like, I went with my girlfriend, but we weren't around each other 24/7. Like, I walked places alone when we were there, and it didn't, like, there are certain parts of certain neighborhoods you don't go to. But
there's neighborhoods in here that you don't get to.
Exactly. Just like Los Angeles, there's neighborhoods. And so that's what I was saying. But like, Americans just, like, foundationally have this belief that we're the only safe part of the world. Mm-hmm. And anywhere else, the moment you leave your house, you're just opening yourself up to get robbed or murdered or whatever.
Yeah.
And I think this movie definitely has that element to it of like, they're easy to manipulate because they're baseline scared of this place, even though it doesn't really, I mean, obviously they have some crazy laws, but it doesn't really seem superficially that scary.
Although, honestly, when you break down the laws to rich people can use their wealth to avoid consequences, they don't sound that crazy anymore.
Right, it's not that different.
Well, sounds
very plausible, actually.
One of like the biggest notes on here, too, is being as like rich than that's how it operates is, why does this government, they just keep letting these people stay and live and just keep fucking with everything? It's so, the money. So having said all that, when he wakes up in the morning, because you immediately also notice like, no, that night, get yourself to the airport, right? Just get back and be like, "I got to take a cab. I'm going to the like." That's at least what I would do if I did a hit and run in a foreign country. We're leaving. I don't care. We're not going to bed. You know, we broke the rules of the resort. Who gives a fuck?
I gotta go.
But they don't do that. The police are immediately at the door in the morning, come see me, and they bring him to this, you know, essentially what looks like also a grimy insane asylum, right? They put him in the white gown, his wife comes with him, and Mia Goth and her husband are nowhere to be found, too, during this whole thing.
Well, yeah, you get the cops are there basically because they gave him up immediately, right?
They
ratted
him out. And even the cops play on it, though, because they do the, when they're interrogating him, they're like, "Oh, well, you know, your wife just spilled the beans on everything," when it was just the good cop, bad cop thing. And he's like, "She did that." And Skarsgård is just like, I mean, I don't know how any of us would react in this situation, but they do really like the fill in that this is a very pathetic man. He's a broken, like, quiet guy, but they basically reveal
just that scared, like they're just so, you know what I mean, they're so terrified, so it's like easy to manipulate, you know. Yeah.
They reveal to him that he The good news is he could get out of this, right? This country has cloning technology.
And also, they say later that nobody's been able to replicate this. So somehow this weird country that's like...
Red goo.
Like, so, it's like supposedly this, like, all, you know, nearly third world-ish kind of, like, you know, outside the walls of these resorts. It's supposed to be all kind of, like, backwards, but yet they have this, like, perfect cloning technology that only exists here. I like that. Yeah, that's fun.
There's a line, and this is a very Cronenberg element. There's a line of dialogue that one of the guys has where it's like, other countries are too technical. They're too scientific in their approach. And Latolka is creative about cloning, artistic about it or whatever. We don't ever find out what that means. But it's kind of like, it's less sci-fi and more fantasy at that
point. I will say that
really
I like...
It really is not, like, you know, it's not a realistic thing. It's like a magical realist element.
I like that their cloning facility still had the kind of, like, spa aesthetic that, like... a resort, like an old, it felt like that was an old resort where they were doing the actual experiments and stuff.
Chamber, that's on purpose.
The chamber that they end up putting him in, there's like these weird Eastern European like tile pattern by you'd expect in like a Polish person's kitchen or something.
Yeah.
Right? Which it does not look like scientific. Like if this were an American sci-fi movie, it would be all white. It would look like an Apple store in there.
Yeah, it feels like you said, like a bathroom of an old mansion or something.
Right. It's very non-scientific. Because again, like the idea that this is not really technology, this is magic. Hang on.
No worries. Sorry, guys.
Taco wanted to get down.
Good. Hi, Taco. Glad we got to see Taco. The world, too, is like they did such a great job of making it look like lived in the purposes. Like, I didn't even think of that, of this, the resort, that the jail was an old resort.
I just got that feeling of like they're doing the cloning, but it feels like a spa treatment. You know, they're putting him in like
it's fascinating that they've made Latolka in a lot of ways like kind of they've coded it otherworldly, where there's just something unnatural about it. Even like that the shot that they use in the trailer when you're first there and you're sort of tipping over 360, like you're seeing normal imagery but upside down or from weird angles, and it's kind of constantly reinforcing this idea that like there are elements of it that are familiar but in a weird, everything is kind of off somehow. There's one more line of dialogue I was gonna bring up at one point when they think they're gonna go kidnap the jailer, the warden, whoever, the public official they've been dealing with.
To get in a surgery or something. They're planning to kidnap him.
He's having a treatment done at Latolka Brain and Spine. That's the name of the clinic where they're picking, which is a bizarre, like, not like those are things we have. Like, there are clinics in America.
You go to brain and spine.
Neurological clinics or whatever, but they wouldn't call it like, it wouldn't be like Los Angeles Brain and Spine. No, that's a weird.
It's a Tim Robinson location.
Right, it's like a larger than life. So yeah, I think Latolka just as a setting is like it's kind of fantastical. It's like there's a magical realist element to it.
The locals, speaking of that, also, you know, they all have this at like every age this, I guess, tattoo or makeup under their eye.
Paint. They put it on in the ceremony.
During the ceremony at the beginning, right? With the same thing with the masks.
The masks are very
like cultural. They put
the little element that they're like, these are our ceremonial masks. Also, you can buy one in the gift shop. Just check those out.
That's straight up just like Hawaii. When you're in Hawaii, they're constantly doing like, this is an ancient sacred Polynesian ritual. And like, here, try it. $5. You know, it's like, it's the
you
most
want
insulting,
this.
Ridiculous. Yeah.
Do that. And then, so this is where I guess there is no answer of it. And you guys might be like, how the hell did you read into this? But so when they get cloned and then basically you get to watch your clone get killed by, and if you committed a murder, this, at least the first one, the guy's son kills clone Skarsgård. But this whole
government time, sanctioned vengeance, you know,
this whole time, very official. I'm thinking, and I think kind of reinforced the second time I watched it too, that they're throwing out the old version, your old version of you, and that's who's dying. And your clone's the one who gets to live with, like, less of your memories, and it's more dumbed down. Because that's how, at least for me, Skarsgård has been playing it the whole time.
Like, he seems like he's getting duller as the movie goes on.
Well, they definitely address
that. They have that conversation, you know,
the first night.
He says, like, what do you think? Do you think that you're still the original you?
Yeah.
Or the copy?
Right. They talk about it a little bit. And then,
yeah.
Because you know,
the way he cries out, I'm like, that's him. He just went through surgery.
But they're identical, though. Like, it wouldn't matter. Because the one who's being killed still has the mind of the other
one. Yeah, that's
one.
What I mean. I guess it doesn't matter, like, if we swapped out, but there was no. But I don't know. It felt like parts were being lost.
But you're saying, is it multiplicity rules? Is Stellan Skarsgård getting dumber each time?
Yeah, it's what it feels
every
like.
Every time they do a copy of the guy. There is another element that I think comes in later. Which is, like, it is kind of also a doppelganger movie on some level. Like, it's creating the tension of, well, is he willing to exist in a world where there are multiples of him? Because then later, they're just freelance on their own making new Skarsgårds. Like, at some point, they stop asking him. It stops being in response to a crime. And they get the formula, and they start cooking them up and paying for them on their own. And I think that's a totally different level of, like, existential dilemma of, like, if there is a double of you that's not being killed, well, now there's just two of you in this world. Like, does that concern you? I mean, you're going to go back home and live your own life. So what if there was another one of you in Latolka living as a dog? But it introduces that tension of, like, in some ways he has to kill these other copies, because then otherwise it's creating this even larger lingering trauma.
There's a Simpsons episode about this.
Yeah,
of course. Right. There is.
But there's a there. Yeah, there's. The, nah. But that's just like that general, like that Lynchian. Like,
no, it's
panic of, like, what if there were more of you?
What would you do? Yeah, and I mean that's even.
Well, how would you have a sense of self if there was another you wandering around out there doing things?
I mean, that's when the scene you're talking about, right? And we're jumping around here and all that, and that's all good, is that scene, right, which they bring out dog Skarsgård, and then he freaks out after beating the shit out of him.
Well, there's two, because there's one where they tell him that they're beating up this jail, this warden or whatever,
and then they reveal,
oh my god, you're right,
they've been beating up a version of him.
That's the thing I'm thinking of, and that's when Mia Goth
later there's another one that is
the dog. Yeah, I'm switching it up, because then Mia Goth is just like, with no concern in the world, and she's like, you both could fuck me if you want. That'd be pretty cool.
And that's just like these hedonists that he's fallen in with, like, that's just another taboo for them that has slipped away, you know? Mm-hmm. Like they're joking about doing sodomy in that one scene when they're all, like, hanging out and drinking. Like, guess which one of us got arrested for sodomy? Like, which is an example of, like, an old taboo that people used to have that rich people on vacation would get rid of, you know, and, like, they're doing drugs and so for them, making a double and then murdering it or having sex with it and then killing it, that's just another thing to do.
That's the thing they've all already experienced. Now they're to the point where they're like, they're getting it, their new experiences to force that on an unsuspecting person.
And she's literally calling him pathetic when he can't deal with it. She's like, don't be pathetic, James.
Yeah, like, oh, we all went through it, James, you big wuss, you big baby.
James,
such a sucky baby.
And I think that's so good in this.
One of the really provocative things about the movie is, like, well, but maybe that might be true of just about anything. If you inundated yourself into it, if you did it a few times, if you got used to it, if you were around other people who were like, that's fine, you could probably grow accustomed to a lot of things that you would normally think are disgusting or
oh yeah, what could be normalized and what could be, you know, what can you be desensitized to, and
just like he becomes to this experience over a few
years. I mean, she really is, in that regard, all that though, is like, whatever the dark fantasy manic pixie dream girl version is, that's who Mia Goth is supposed to be, right?
It's
just like she's
the magic demon death girl.
I mean, that's true, but I think that, I mean, again, that's also what's so what's so, I think, provocative about the movie in some ways is that there's the turn. So for most of the movie, you think she's like James's friend and they met on vacation and she's just like introducing him to this weird dark world.
Yeah, they do the drugs, have some or like,
and then there's a turn where it becomes, yeah, then there's a turn where it becomes obvious that like, oh no, she's fucking with him and she's an enemy and she's been abusing him this whole time.
But there's also a bit of the movie where we have realized that and he hasn't.
Yes. Right. And that's, I think we realized that earlier.
You know?
Yeah. But then I think almost any other filmmaker would have left it there. Like either he gets away or he gets his revenge or he gets killed or whatever, end of movie. And I think what's so fascinating about this one is that he gives you that there's another turn where it's like, well, no, she wasn't really a nemesis anyway. She was just on vacation. This is literally just what they do.
They go back to normal.
And then the morning they get up to go to the airport, it's just like leaving any other vacation where, well,
the banality
you're done with all that
of evil, you know.
Yeah, you're getting your bags and going back home. And she wasn't really, like, she didn't hate him. Her husband says, hey, I hope we see you back here next year, and means it. It's not a joke. That's probably how they all became friends, is they all experienced this together and had a wild week. And then
a year later, we're like, I think I'm ready to do that again.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's what makes it, because you can. And then James doesn't leave. I mean, when we leave, he's back on the beach.
Shot.
So the idea that he is going to be back, Nick, he is now one of them. And
or that he's so broken he can never go back to his normal life.
That's what I took it like.
Or like, both. I mean, but it's sort of both. Like, but he will go back to
he's
his
definitely
normal
never
life.
Going to be the same.
But no, yeah, right, he has been maybe. Broken, and he will have to keep going back there and doing this because now he's obsessed with it. Like,
and that's one thing it glossed over too is like his wife left. She waited for the week because he played a game. He's like, I can't find my passport because he was so enticed in this and that. We later learn it's taped underneath the sink. And she's like, okay, well, I'm going. You just stayed up all night. God did God knows what. And now there's two of these urns. Because when you get cloned, they cremate the body, you get an urn.
I thought the urn would make any horror fan who needs, like, you know, a decoration for their home, one of those urns would be great. You know, it's nice. It's a real simplistic design. Very classy.
Oh, infinity pool decoration?
Yeah.
Oh, if
you,
this
you got that
a,
next to your little lament configuration.
Don't worry.
And
don't
you got,
worry.
Like, little horror knickknacks. You know?
Don't worry. If this wasn't a Neon movie and this was an A24 movie, they would be trying to sell you those urns for like
$95. If this was A24, they'd be selling you the masks.
Yeah, the masks.
Yeah, that more likely.
I'd get that one with the, I like the one with the coins in the mouth. I was a big fan of that one.
But yeah, they bring them back that one night, and that's like the first night too, right? They go rough up the people at the house and accidentally shoot, or not accident, nothing seems like an accident, you know, but they shoot someone and they're like, oh shit, but they're all just bumbling around drunk, like you said, like just keep kind of that fun, like when you do dumb shit.
Consequence free, you know?
Yeah, consequence
free. I do like
they
laughter. Do the, I do like the little twist they do on that one where, you know, they do the fake out and you think it's actually, they're really going to get killed this time. And then it cuts to there and the audience clapping and watching themselves all get
killed.
They're
having fun with it.
That was a great little, I mean, it's, you kind of can see it coming, but I think it still works really well.
I think
it really, it's the only moment where it drives home the cruelty. Cause it's not from the rest of it is from their perspective and they don't care. They're very cavalier about these.
Well,
lives.
It's like we were talking about, if they have the exact same memories, they think they're the original. So to them, it is all very real. They are having that experience.
That's
and
our
then,
only
you know,
chance as viewers to really experience like how awful this is from every other perspective, but theirs. And so I think, you need to have that moment, but framing it as a surprise, I think is very effective.
And it is when we get our first, like, crazy Mia goth face, one of, like, five in this movie, of her shooting a gun and just, like, laughing maniacally.
Mia goth are maybe the first naturally occurring scream queen we've had in a really long time. Like, where her ascent to, like, her place in horror feels like it came nice and natural and not, like, you know, Jenna Ortega feels a little forced with the
a
screen
little bit,
thing
yeah.
and Wednesday
no
and like
forest.
The promotion.
Also, she like a little boring.
Thank you.
I don't hate her. She's not bad. She was good as Wednesday Addams, I guess. But like, I don't. She doesn't stand out as a presence in those movies enough to be our new Scream Queen. Like, you got to make a that. The whole thing with Scream Queen is you only have a few minutes. You got to make an impression.
I was always under the impression the other girl was the star of the new Scream movies, her sister, and that she was like the secondary kind of. It wasn't until Wednesday came out and everybody's like, Jenna Ortega. I was like, oh, really?
Is she just in horror movies? Didn't do much for me, sorry.
Yeah, she's just in a bunch of horror.
But no, Mia Goth naturally, and it's interesting. If you look, they're all kind of like, they're not typecasting, but they're all like, except for, we're talking about Mia Goth, like erotic horror too, right? Like I mean, Nymphomaniac isn't horror, but Nymphomaniac to X to Pearl to Maxine to now this, you know, she has this through line.
Oh, and she's so in isn't she in Cure for Wellness.
But
well,
yeah,
you know, she's a beautiful girl and she's not she's really open about her sexuality to the point where, like, you know, she's interested in pursuing those roles and stuff.
Yeah, there's
so
no
she gravitates toward that sort of stuff. So
that wasn't a knock, just super different from your average Scream Queen. But yeah, the Jenna Ortega thing is, I said that to someone once and they looked like I like shot their mom in the face. And I was like, that's just kind of forced upon us.
Yeah, like, it just feels like a real Evanescence situation. Like, here's a band that we produced for you to like. And
we could all go out and pretend to be Winona Ryder in Beetlejuice and wear black and, like, be like, see? But, yeah, no. So in an Infinity Pool, though, we're going through it. And, I don't know, just crazier and crazier shit gets going. And especially when they introduce that drug. And there is some imagery that has stuck with me throughout the year of seeing this movie, and especially that pulsating out nipple, it lives in my brain as
well. That's an interesting thing about that. Some things we see in that psychedelic trip out sequence are prophetic, like, because that sort of references how he sucks on her boob at the end of the movie, but that hasn't happened yet.
He's a little baby.
He's seeing visions of things that have not yet happened during his psychedelic freak out as well. Again, like a magical realist element to the movie, like things in Latolka that are not physically possible elsewhere in the world can happen in Latolka.
He also in those visions too, like, said, haven't happened in the world. The one that also sticks with me so much too is like later on in when he sees his wife again, right? Because she's really not part of anything, and he sees her in those sequences as, oh my god, you were in on this the whole time in one of those visions.
Yeah, he has like some fantasies or some, you know, nightmares that she's a part of, right?
Like, yeah, right. And that's I don't know, like, that's always freaky when it's someone you've trusted and thought about.
Well, you know, he's feeling about, you know, he's dealing with guilt there because of all the weird shitties, you know. So of course she's gonna show up to kind of represent that in a way, I think. And
I mean, and also the re-looking at my notes too, the visuals and the fantasies and orgies. Didn't it also feel like when you were like illegal cable streaming of like the scrambly channels, like Spice
trying
channels,
to watch porn to the scrambles?
Yeah, like the way it's shot and filtered through, it's very like, is that a nipple or an elbow?
Well, and I was just having a weird week with nipples because I rewatched Species, and I don't know if you guys remember that. That's a Giger creation in that, and the Species creature has tentacles that come out of the nipples in a couple different places in the movie. So it's like, it seemed like there was a lot of real weird nipple stuff going on in the movies. Well, I was watching those the last couple days.
It gives life or nourishment.
Well, but again, I mean, there's a lot of that kind of, you know, she calls him a sucky baby also at one point. And just the idea that when we're talking about creating life without non-biologically. So I think it's, you know, that kind of idea of everything, even the most basic biological processes are getting confused and mixed up. Like, Latolka is wrong on this very very well, and core, I mean, like when baseline organic way, you know,
when
like,
they make life the first doesn't even clone, happen naturally. When they make the first clone and they go see him and he's got his face like through the, that's a very like
Willy Wonka
kind of look, you know.
Yeah,
what I mean?
But like alien birth, like not like anything right. natural from this world, exactly.
Yeah. Now, can you guys explain to me why the eating and spitting of the cherries was actually the grossest thing in this fucking movie?
I figure that might as well have been Dog James right there. He's basically right. degraded to the point he's the animal already.
He's strung out at that.
Yeah,
but
he's strung out.
It's the visually grossest scene. I mean, in the sense of just like the red. And they're spitting and they're. I think that right after that
even,
is my...
Even when you get cherries in juice, it's not like, it's not that kind. They put some kind of viscous syrup
thing in there.
Yeah, it's gooey in an unnatural way.
Mostly, I was just feeling for the dad, because like, you know how much money he spent to take his family on this nice resort. Now you got this asshole spitting
so that
pits,
is,
cherry pits at him.
That's where my question of, why does, even with the money they're spending, why do the resorts let these people be here? Because there's other people at these resorts paying money, and they're just like...
Yeah, but that guy in the polo shirt ain't never going to drop whatever it is, a couple $1 million, and get a clone made of himself. They need to... They're fishing for whales at this resort. That guy's paying the water bill, but he ain't keeping the doors open, you know? They need an Alexander Skarsgård.
I guess when you put it that way. But I mean,
I do think it's something about the Lotulkin character. You know, the Lotulkins are a very passionate people, as we learn early on. There is a sense, I think, that they are, if not enjoying this, that this is a lifestyle for them. Like, occasionally you murder an American tourist, and it's a thing you do.
Yeah,
it's fine. No worries about that.
You know you're going to get your restitution at least if one of these freaks does something to you or your family. You're going to get a cut. I'm sure a cut of the money they pay goes to the family, and then you also are going to get your government sanctioned vengeance on them. You know?
We also learn it's like the very end of the tourist season. Like this group plans their trips for like the tail end when it's less crowded and less people around. So maybe that's part of why.
So they can get a little crazier, probably.
Right, they wouldn't tolerate this at the peak of the tourist season. But if you're there the last few weeks when they're emptying out anyway, sure.
And they're trying to squeeze the last couple bucks out of these guys.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
He extends his stay pretty much indefinitely too, so that makes sense. He's like, give me another month.
By the last scene, when it's pouring rain, it's the rainy season. The rest of the resort has cleared out. Yeah. He's the only one left.
He's just one of them. And I also love how impressed, too, just remembering how the rich people, when they do rob, like, the local government, or the not local government, the people that work there, how impressed they are with all the good stuff they have, like the whiskey and the cigars. And like things they would be able to get anyway.
They thought they were like backwater, you know.
They're like, this is the third world.
Oh, they actually got some nice stuff here.
Yeah, he just pulls out, I think, a bottle of like Woodward Reserve. It looked like too. Like, so I mean, there's just a lot of interesting little elements, and I know Juan, you've said a few bunch of times. It's just so well directed and such good choices in the movie.
Yeah.
But yeah, then he really jumping to here, so please interrupt me where I need to. But then you know, he does try to run away after that at one point, right? And this is the don't be pathetic and so unattractive, James. They with their guns in the convertible stop his bus that's taking him to the airport. And basically
they roll up on him like the Devil's Rejects or something.
Like, it felt like the Devil's Rejects.
They feel like the Devil's Rejects if they were like some yuppies instead of like the gross, disgusting Rob Zombie characters.
It's a great, because then they're just like that pretty long scene of her on top of the convertible just slowly chasing him.
Yeah.
And you know, just giving him the business. And then when he finally breaks down, like you said, he sucks her boob like a little baby.
They shoot him, right, and he runs off, and she gets him, and then he ends up being tended to by the family of the farmer that they ran over, right?
That's what it's alluded to, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's unclear. Well, some of that stuff is fantasy. It's unclear because he has a dream
that the boy is there.
Probably that is what happened.
That's when he sees his wife and stuff. But again,
it reinforces this idea of they're not monsters. The Latolkins are not evil people. Like, they're helping to care for him. It's the it's these other Westerners that he's brought in that are the problem.
It's when he freaks out and I think starts choking who's ever over him, or that's we think it's the boy.
He's fantasizing that the boy who killed his double is now murdering him. But probably the line between reality and fiction by then is blurred.
When he actually comes to and they're there, they've obviously tracked him very easily. He just stumbled to the first place. They followed him there. And that's when they bring him out, and they bring out the dog version of James.
Yes.
And they're like, you basically, like, now prove that you deserve to be the James that lives, kind of, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, at that point, like, we later realize it's like an initiation. It's like, well, that was part of their sort of sick, weird club.
So would this make it on the website, doesthedogdie.com, then?
Oh, I mean, technically, you know, it is the dog.
No, I think it's a human dog. That doesn't count.
Doesn't count. No one's feeling too bad for
James. Nobody
cares
if it's you can kill a human dog.
I just used that website the other day. I think that's the only reason why that note is in there. The night before, my wife and I watched the number 23 for How to Skin Any Purposes. And I was like, I just want to make sure we're not watching a So Bad It's Good movie where we got to see dog murder.
Yeah.
It will sneak it in on you sometimes.
It's a valuable website.
I did not know that existed till right now.
Yes,
I've been blindly going in and just seeing dogs die in movies without ever knowing.
My mom texts me. I'll get text messages. She'll be like, "Have you seen this? Is the dog okay?" And I'll have to like, sometimes I don't remember.
Yeah.
Like, how do you not remember? So like, funny. I don't know. It's not a real dog.
I know that the actor dog is fine.
It's fine.
In certain horror movies, it's such a lazy plot device to shock the audience. So that website does exist. If anyone, or
I don't really mind because I know it's a fake. Listen,
it's fake.
If it was a real dog, I would be very upset.
Oh, I don't. I'm not.
You can kill a fake dog, but I'll tell you the trope I don't like is the dog runs off after whatever the terrifying thing is,
and then you just hear
in the distance, how you know. I don't like that's lazy. Like, I get that you don't want to show us the dog being exploded or whatever because that's upsetting, but like, you can't just do the trope, you gotta come up with it.
Weirdly enough, you know who kind of did that in a good way? It's not a good movie, but in the Mark Wahlberg Fear. How you kind of hear a dog disappears.
I was just going to say, and then it's through the doggy.
Yeah, you got to do something else. You got to mix it up somehow, because otherwise it's just like, we've all seen that scene a million times.
Well, right, I mean, it's in First Blood, I mean, for God's sake, you know? And once Rambo's smoked your Dobermans, you know, there's no one.
It's old as the hills at this point. I'm tired. I did that. Taco is eyeing me now, like, what the fuck? Who? What did you say?
I don't like. What are you guys talking about?
Fuck! Did you just say?
Sorry, Taco. We'll move on. It's sensitive. But yeah. So, and then that's kind of like where he is initiated into it. And then earlier, Lon, you mentioned, because it happens about twice in the movie in separate parts, is then just how casually the core group just talks about their life and plans and what they're going to go to. And I think it's when James Foster buys into it, that's when it's over. And he's like, wait, I thought you guys told me you lived here all year round. Right? Because the way Mia Goth or Gabby sets it up is she's like, well, we did an architecture thing and then we just stayed and now we're kind of trapped. Like, this is just what we do.
I think they make it clear that they're on vacation.
And okay.
They have a regular life. He's a he's an architect. She's a model.
So I took that. Right.
But they make a point to come back every year.
This is their yearly. They come here every year for this vacation.
All these missing.
But yeah, but it's like I guess I would liken it to at least I've heard. I wouldn't know for sure myself, but like. A night of really hard drugs, you know what I mean? And then, like, you come to the next day and, like, the real world is just kind of there and you're like, oh my gosh, I gotta go back and, like, live my regular life again.
Oh, we're talking about allegedly.
And I just don't feel, like, I haven't shook off the, like, the kind of, like, debauchery of it all, you know?
We're talking about allegedly.
Living their normal life and doing their, you know.
I've allegedly lived that. A few times where you're like, I need a few. My wife with that. I'm like, you go out, it takes so much out of you mentally of like being on. And then for like a couple of days, you're just like, I don't feel bad. I need to go back to normal because I stayed up all night drinking or doing drugs or whatever it is.
And I think, I mean, to me, that's what's so interesting about the movie is the suggestion that, well, it is sort of like any other vacation. Like, they'll go back to their regular life. They'll kind of disconnect from this whole experience and get back into the everyday of living their sort of humdrum lives. And then next year they'll go on vacation. And like, there are people who go on vacation and like get crazy for a week and then go home and go back to their normal lives. And like, this is just these people's versions of it. And again, it's that idea that like, you could get used to a lot of stuff probably, right? Like in the right circumstances with the right people around you, egging you on, like you could integrate a lot of different stuff and compartmentalize it and move on with your with your normal life. And I like, it does leave the fact that James doesn't leave is, I think, the only part of this that leaves you with that idea that he's permanently changed by this experience. Like, yeah. I think you could have had him leave Latolka and go back home with the rest of the group, and it would have been like, yeah, he's going to go back to his regular life and probably not even think about this that much. Mm-hmm. Like, in a few weeks, this will fade to the back of his mind. It's like that crazy vacation I went on.
Write his next book, right?
Like, that's, well, you just think that he's going to be like one of them now. He will, like, you know, whereas with the way it ends, that you're kind of left thinking, like, maybe not. Like, maybe he's not built for this, you know?
It's such an interesting thing, too. He doesn't have a ton of dialogue, Skarsgård. A lot of the movie is just that far off kind of stare of him, like, processing everything he's going through.
Kind of desperation eyes a lot of the time.
And it does leave you to, like, kind of fill in a lot of the blanks of, like, well, what is he experiencing in this moment?
Yeah. Watching this.
Brandon Cronenberg does that in all his movies. They're all, like, there's a lot of staring. There's a lot of contemplating. Blank there's slate. A lot of, like. Yeah, what is, like, Caleb Landry Jones in Antiviral has a lot of that, where he's just kind of looking off in the distance. You're like, what's going on with him right now?
Yeah, I wonder what he's going to do next.
Whatever, you decide. What do you think he's thinking about? It's art, baby.
I think at first he's thinking, it's going to be good for my next book. And then
that's what he's really thinking. Like, finally, I'll have something decent to write about.
No one will believe me, too. We'll just change the name of the country. It's super interesting. It was also like, I think I saw this first time I saw this was like right after, like, because he was just on that last season of Succession, right after, and his character in Succession and just being that type of, you know, billionaire, but that doesn't give a shit about everything. It's the same person almost. I was like,
yeah.
It's a weird juxtaposition of character, but he's becoming such a good actor. And like, I feel like solid when I see his name and things. I don't know. I feel like we've gone through the movie quite a bit. What do you guys have? Any, things we didn't bring up, extra, you know, not extra, other things to talk about Infinity Pool that we missed?
I feel pretty good. I think we got to most of it.
Yeah, I think the only note I had, and it's just a very obvious thing, was that I was getting a lot of, like, the Westworld vibes of, like, a play place for the rich to kind of just come and indulge in their, like, their violent fantasies and then kind of go home consequence-free, you know, and that, especially at the end, where they're just going to get on the bus, and Mia Goth looks so much like, I've just seen women in that travel gear so much. Like, you got the comfy sweater, hair pulled up,
yeah.
You know, you're like, you're on the go, but you're dressed for comfort, and it's just this is just a little vacay for them, you know.
Another thing to notice too of that is talking about the cloning, and I guess this answers my question from earlier too, is, you know, her husband gets shot in the leg and then is cloned again to be completely fine. Like, he's not walking around with
Yeah, does he have a cane or something at the end? I can't
briefly
remember.
Briefly, he has a cane, but it's healed.
They used to be healing. It's just, do you think they just dip your leg in the red stuff and that heals you up? Kind of like a back to tank, you know?
You just don't think about it. No, this is a... I was going to say fun. It's not fun. It's a super interesting movie. And it's been one of those ones, I don't know, I've shown now, at least all three of us. It has that rewatchability, but sometimes these more intense movies, at least for myself, don't have a rewatchability to them.
I really liked this one. I was surprised how much I liked it. Like I said, I feel like I had seen a lot of, we're rich people, we're in a crazy situation in a fancy place, and that had been kind of like a trope the last two or three years, and not that they have, there's been some really good ones too. It's that
I just watched Ready or Not. I just talked about Ready or Not last night on Ready or Not, and like it's the same,
really,
you know,
fun one.
Eat the rich commentary,
but I feel like this one was really good, and I liked it a little. I think I like it a little better than Possessor, although I want to rewatch Possessor again,
Possessor.
I think I've seen this one twice. I only saw Possessor once, so I want to go back and revisit that. But either way, a really good movie. I would recommend this one for sure.
I really like that Cronenberg is also, or Brandon Cronenberg is becoming, towing a line into this, good sci-fi horror that we don't get a lot of, too. It's not just...
He's better Neil Blomkamp.
Maybe.
I don't know if you saw that demonic movie. You know what I'm talking about.
I did not.
Don't do it. Just don't do it. It's fine.
I feel bad that my shelf, I have a Blomkamp 3-pack because it came in a lot. I bought on Facebook because I like District 9.
Yeah.
But it's
just Chappie. Just had to have
Chappie. I had to have Chappie. It's a really nice package. But
it is a nice looking little box set, though.
It makes it seem like I'm the world's biggest block.
I was gonna say, does it look, this the side has his name down the spine? It really makes it seem like he's this auteur.
The alien cubed thing.
This auteur filmmaker, here's his collection.
It's just...
No Gran Turismo? Forget it.
Oh my.
Got to get that one. It's a true story, you know. I was fucking
one real guy who races one time played a video game. That's the true story.
Every ad, I remember watching the trailer for that being like, is the trailer? Oh no, it's just a doc behind the scene featurette was the trailer for every AMC movie this summer.
Yeah.
Anyway, Lon, anything you'd like to plug or not plug, you're going to plug. But say about Infinity Pool and then plug it in.
No, I think we covered Infinity Pool. I feel good about it. I feel like we got it all in there.
Fantastic. Lam, what would you like to plug and let people know where you're at? I know you usually have a few things cooking around.
Oh, you could follow me on whatever it's called. X Twitter, the former Twitter, Elon Musk's Twitter, at LONS over there. That's where I share everything I'm working on. And you should sign up for my newsletter. It's free. It's called Inside Streaming. It's got everything happening in streaming TV. I do calendar, I do news every day, headlines, whatever you want. That's inside.com/streaming.
It's very good.
And there's so much streaming. I think all the time about how much stuff I'm missing and just keeping up on even reporting on it, let alone trying to watch so much of it.
Yeah, I mean, I think the one thing I do every day is just here's everything that's going on all the big streaming platforms today. And just that is there's no good place for that. People are constantly like, I didn't even know this was out. It's like, well, now, just today, my friend PJ was like, hey, just learned that John Carpenter true crime show went up on Peacock.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, a couple days ago. Yeah.
And I do a calendar. So the day that came out, I wrote about it in Inside Streaming. So if you got
I'm nervous about that one. I didn't realize that it was I thought it was just going to be a John Carpenter anthology show, and I didn't realize it was true crime. Yeah. And then it's like, kind of like stylized real crimes. It kind of makes me feel a little gross. Like, I agree.
I'm not into true crime at all. And once I found out it was like, oh, he's doing that thing, I got a lot less.
It's an interesting pick for John Carpenter, right? Yeah. Like,
I haven't decided. I can still see myself giving it at least an episode, but I don't know. It definitely felt a little grimier and a little less interesting to me once I found out that's what it was.
Yeah. I did want to ask you, Lon, and I guess I probably should say this for all, about that, if you got any of it or watched any of that Goosebumps show. No, I
haven't. I was a little old for the Goosebumps books. Like that was like right after I sort of aged out. When I was a kid, John Bellairs was the author that kids read, like the early horror. They ended up adapting. Jack Black did a movie version of one of his books, The House with a Clock.
Oh, that movie's great.
Okay, that's a pretty good movie, actually.
I loved that book. In the early 80s, when I first got into reading horror books, John Bellairs was the guy that kids read. It was pre-R.L. Stine. So I didn't grow up with Goosebumps, so no, I haven't checked that out yet.
Gotcha. No, it's been fun enough. I wish it stayed anthology. I'm liking, but they're doing the thing that everything is, it's all interconnected and overlapping story and everything. Yeah. But Brian and I always say that House on the Clock in the Walls is actually a spiritual sequel to the Goosebumps movies that came out in 2015.
They all have Jack Black in them. They feel very similar.
It's actually the exact opposite. John Bellairs was first, yes. And then R.L. Stine kind of ripped on his
But the way
ideas,
the movies came the out, way the and movies even came the fact out. That they both right. have Jack Black
oh,
in
for
them.
Sure,
and, like,
for sure.
They yeah. feel like a trilogy. You know, they all
yeah,
like, feel
no,
like...
definitely. And it's a real shame because that book, House with the Clock in Its Walls, like that character that Jack Black is playing, he's in a bunch of books. It's like a whole... It's a whole, John Bellairs wrote a whole franchise about those characters, and like, it wasn't a big enough hit, so we'll never get to see any of them.
That's a bummer, because they were
There's
good.
A lot of kids' movies that I really liked that came out when my son was younger that didn't. That one, the kid that would be king was really good.
Yeah.
What about the John C. Reilly?
Just didn't move the needle, you know, all the Laika movies, you know? Yeah.
Was the vampire one with John C. Reilly or whatever. Vampire's Assistant.
Oh, yeah, I don't remember that one, but I know which one you're talking about. Vampire's Assistant or something.
Anyway, I could sit here and talk about children's horror for way too long.
A perfect end to our Infinity Pool episode.
Yes. A nice double feature of Goosebumps, Haunted Halloween, and Infinity Pool with your six-year-old. All right. You can find Brian and I also on the Twitters and this show and everything. Come say hi. Stay frightful, everyone. Bye.
Welcome to Flyover State of Fear.